We're going to be in Matthew 23 tonight. Mike, you have no chill. For class, I was thinking, you know what? It'd be really good if we just like read up to where we've covered so far. And my first thought was, we couldn't do that. That's too many verses. I was like, oh, it's just 15 verses. So yeah, we can actually read that. As for the people who have made estimates on how many verses we'll get to tonight, you might not be wrong, but we're going to do the best we can. So, Matthew 23, give me just a little bit of background information. What have we covered so far? Who is speaking? Who's being spoken to? What's the context? Okay, Jesus is speaking. Who is he speaking to? Scribes and Pharisees. What is the gist of his message? What is he accusing them of? Sum it up in one or two sentences. Hypocrisy. Okay. And give me some quick points about hypocrisy. What does that look like? Okay, preaching and not practicing. Yeah, so someone's made the comment, your audio doesn't match your video. Okay. Yes? Do as I say, not as I do. That's good. What else? Hypocrisy. Okay. So we're going to get into that a bit tonight. Would someone like to read Matthew 23, 1 through 15? Wes, you have a strong voice. Read that for us.
Matthew 23, 1 through 15. Then Jesus spoke to the multitude and his disciples, saying, "The scribes and the Pharisees sit at Moses' seat. Therefore, whatever they tell you to observe, that observe and do, but do not do according to the works, for they say and do not do. For they bind heavy burdens, hard to bear, and they lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers, but all their works they do to be seen by men. They make their
phylacteries
broad and enlarged the borders of their garments, and they love the best places at the feast, the best seats in the synagogues, greetings in the marketplaces, and to be called by men, Rabbi, Rabbi. But you do not be called Rabbi, for the one is your teacher, the Christ, and you are all brethren. Do not call anyone on earth your father, for one is your father, he who is in heaven. And do not be called teachers, for one is your teacher, the Christ. But he who is greatest among you shall be your servant. And whoever exalts him will be humbled. And he who humbles himself will be exalted. But woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men, for you neither go yourselves, nor do you allow those who enter to go in. Woe to you, you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you devour widows' houses, and at pretense make long prayers. Therefore, you will receive greater condemnation. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you travel land and sea to win one proselyte. And when he is won, you make him twice as much a son of hell as yourselves."
Thank you. Okay. So that's what we've covered up to this point. Really, again, I'll harp on this one more time. The introduction, the first 12 verses of this chapter are really the key to understanding the thrust of the chapter, what he's trying to say. The woes, if you understand the context, then the woes make more sense, number one. But number two, they're also just kind of self-explanatory. So that's why we spent as long as we did in the first 12 verses. But we've gone down through verse 15. The next woe is 16 through 22. Would someone like to read that? Verses 16 through 22.
"Woe to you, blind guides, who say, 'Whoever swears by the temple, it is nothing. But whoever swears by the gold of the temple, he is obliged to perform it.' Fools and blind, for which is greater, the gold or the temple that sanctifies the gold? And whoever swears by the altar, it is nothing. But whoever swears by the gift that is on it, he is obliged to perform it. Fools and blind, for which is greater, the gift of the altar that sanctifies the gift? Therefore, he who swears by the altar swears by it and by all things on it."
Through 22, please.
Through 22.
Yes, sir.
He who swears by the temple swears by it and by him who dwells in it. And he who swears by heaven swears by the throne of God and by him who sits on it.
Okay, thank you. So what is he saying here? What are the Pharisees and scribes trying to get away with through these oaths? They were essentially pulling it over on people, and they were making oaths, and they were saying, well, I swear by the altar that I'll do this. I swear by the gift on the altar. But then they would come around whenever it was time to pay their due, you know, fulfill the oath. They say, oh, you see, I didn't swear by the altar. I swear by the gift on the altar, and so I don't technically have to keep that oath. And so they were using verbal trickery to get out of their promises. I don't even know like where to start. Like they were just using cheap trickery so they wouldn't have to keep their word. I've heard it said that a person is only as good as their word. Do you agree with that statement? If so, why? Why is it important that we be trustworthy? Yes.
Controlling our tongue is kind of how you can tell where a person is spiritually.
Okay, controlling the tongue. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's right. Did you have something? Okay. I'm assuming it wasn't you. Victor.
I think it's a point that would be trustworthy because one big reason is we as Christians, one of our jobs is to bring the gospel to other people. And if you can trust what we say,
that's right.
They're not going to, you know, trust the message we bring.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, the principle is there in Scripture. If you can't be trusted with a small thing, how can you be trusted with a large thing? And so we talked about, you know, honesty and the value of the truth. And we'll come back to Mike's sermon this morning quite a bit this evening because there's a lot of correlation between the two. But if I can't be trusted to tell the truth in small things, like I'm going to be at a certain place at a certain time, then how can I be trusted with something like the gospel or something as fundamental as doctrine? And the reality is I can't. Bobby?
Many years ago, how much, you know, your word, you know, the truth, you know, a handshake.
That's right,
you know,
yeah.
That meant your word, mm-hmm. And that was it.
Yeah.
Today, you know, you got to sign 20 pages.
That's right. And even then, you can typically get out of it if there's loopholes in the wording. Right.
And how much that's changed.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
So your organ's everything because it's not your credit, but credibility is now damaged.
Okay, so it damages our credibility. Why is our credibility important then?
We represent Christ.
We represent Christ. What is the connection between our credibility and our relationship with Jesus? Because I claim to follow him, right? I mean, like when I say I am a Christian, I claim to be a disciple, a follower of Jesus. And so if I don't keep my word, if I'm not credible, if I'm not honest, if I'm not trustworthy, then how does that reflect back on the person that I'm following? And that goes back to the point that we made last week about the Pharisees making their disciples. They were making their disciples, and their disciples were worse than they were because the disciples weren't even trying to follow the law. They were only following the lead of the Pharisees. And that's why they were as bad as they were. So yeah, it affects how people see Jesus, and that affects people's salvation. So if my word isn't good, that can ultimately play a part in someone being lost. So yeah, very good points. Anything else?
Well, it's supposed to be Christ.
Eric. Yeah?
See that people see that he is in us, what comes out of our mouth.
Yeah.
That's the people, almost what he says. He's the example.
Yeah.
That we have to go by and be like, not just whatever we want.
Sure. Royce?
In our word, and our word is a reflection not of just one Christ, but of his church. If people, if our word is not true, if we're not credible within the community, they're going to look at the church as going, well, why would I want to be a part of that?
That's right.
And so it's all interconnected. You can't separate one from the other in reality. They're intertwined.
That's right. Yeah. Let's read a few passages together really quick. Miss Evelyn, will you read James 5:12? Mike, will you get Psalm 15:4? Olivia, will you get Matthew 5:33-37? Please. And then, Kirsten, do you want to read? Colossians 3:9. So,
but above all, my brethren, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or with any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no, no, lest you fall into judgment.
What is the connection between making oaths and judgment, do you think?
We don't have anything that we can swear on.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good way of wording it. Yeah. Okay, good. Mike, I believe Psalm 15:4.
In whose eyes a vile person is despised, but he honors those who fear the Lord. He who swears to his own hurt and does not change.
I remember the phrase there that we want to emphasize in Psalm 15:4 is he swears to his own hurt and does not change. Don Walker really emphasized this verse to us. And he emphasized, you know, you agree to go preach for a congregation. You know, I'm going to preach for you for the next 6 months, every other Sunday. You're going to give me $250 a month or $250 a week to drive out and to come preach for you and to come back Sunday nights. And then another congregation contacts you and says, I'll give you $500 to do the same thing. I've already made a commitment to that first congregation. That's an example of swearing to our hurt. I've already made a commitment to someone else, and it hurts me in the long run financially. It hurts me to not go with your offer, but I can't because I've already given my word. So that's the idea of swearing to your own hurt. And people in business know this. You know, I'm sure many of us have had situations where it'd be very lucrative for us to go back on an agreement that we had, maybe one that wasn't on paper, and to say, well, I'm not going to uphold that. You know, I've got a better offer on the table. I'm going to go with this other offer. It doesn't matter. If I've already given someone my word, the context of Psalm 15:4 is the person who's going to dwell with God. You know, a citizen of Zion, a person who's going to have a relationship with God, should be so trustworthy. If I say I'm going to do something, then I'm not going to go back on that. You should be able to trust my word. Yes?
Going back, I'm sorry, to the James, I was just mm-hmm. looking up that word, fall into judgment, which I found okay. to be interesting. It actually carries the idea of hypocrisy. In the original Greek, it goes back to yeah. the idea of falling into hypocrisy. So
yeah.
if you're making an oath, you might put yourself in a position to where you can't fulfill it.
That's right.
So yeah. now you are the hypocrite because you said you promised you would and you didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're looking like you're falling into judgment. So when yeah. you're going to say yes, know that it's something you're saying yes to. If you're going to say no, know it's something you
yeah.
can say no to because then you can fall into hypocrisy.
Yeah, and that brings up the principle of weighing our words. You know, before we just blindly agree to something or before we make a commitment, it's best to slow down and to not necessarily make decisions as quickly as we can. Sometimes we need to be decisive. Sometimes it's like, okay, no, this is right. You know, I'm going to obey the gospel today. You know, I'm not going to sit and think about this for 6 months kind of thing. But then on the flip side of that, there are things that, you know what, I need to soak on this a little bit. I don't have to make the decision today. I don't have to give you a yes or a no right now. It's very important for us to weigh our words. What am I agreeing to? What am I committing myself to? This is good, but is it ultimately going to take me so far away from my family that I start shirking my responsibilities to my family? And that, of course, isn't beneficial to anyone. So, yeah.
This conversation makes me appreciate something my dad used to say when I was a kid, and I didn't understand it fully. He said, I hate when people put fine print on the contracts.
Mm. Yeah.
Everything should be lined up in the contract. What's the fine print for?
Yeah.
Because there's always something in the fine print that possibly the person who can benefit the most can get out of the contract.
Mm-hmm.
Which Christians, their word ought to be their word. If you say something, you ought to do it.
Yeah.
And if you don't, then you are the hypocrite.
Yeah.
Which you think of the generation we live in today where standards really don't mean anything, it's hard to be the hypocrite if I didn't really mean that in the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, we could bring that into the realm of marriage. You know, Dad always used to say to us, when you say you do, you better, because you're gonna. You know, there are no take-backs, if you will. And that's the way, unfortunately, people in our world approach marriage. It's like, well, that was a fun 2 months, but, you know, I'm moving on. You know, I've got better things on the horizon. No. You hitched your wagon, and that's done. You know, so, and that reemphasizes the idea of before we make those major decisions, we better make sure that this is going to be something that I'm okay with in the long term. You know, for the rest of my life, I'm making a commitment to something, and I'm not going to do that lightly. So when we married someone, we promised. We made a promise, not only between us and that other person, but ultimately to God, that sickness or health, you know, I'm there. Regardless of the complications that may come from that, I'm committed. It's the value of our word.
Sorry, I don't want to get off topic. I don't want to have a plan.
That's all right. If we only cover this point, we'll still get through 6 verses, and that's double what y'all estimated. So,
thinking about that too, with our vow, God is holding us to our vow. God is holding us to our word. And one of the things that I hear people say when it comes to marriage is, you're bringing it, is that, you know, as far as divorce, well, you know, repentance covers that, baptism covers that. But the vow you made was never a sin.
That's right.
So baptism doesn't uncover something
right.
that was never a sin
yeah.
to begin with.
That's right.
God is holding you to that vow you made.
Yeah.
And so baptism doesn't undo the vow. Because
right.
the vow is not a sin.
Yeah.
And I think we forget that when we're explaining to people the importance of keeping your word, because God is going to hold you to it
mm-hmm.
for life.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is just goes understated often because we overlook that very important aspect of marriage.
Yeah. Olivia and I have had interactions with people, and their word changes every other day. So they make a commitment to you, and 2 weeks later you bring up that commitment, and the commitment has shifted. And no notice was given to you, no explanation why. We're not going to uphold that. And that puts a really bad taste in your mouth, you know, because you're giving me the impression that I really can't trust anything that you tell me. Even if it's in writing, it's still something that's at time dodged. And if we're that way as Christians and we claim to follow Jesus, you know, that's the furthest thing in the world from adorning the gospel. We're trying to make the gospel beautiful. We're trying to make it attractive to people, you know. Not based on the works that I'm doing, wow, that person is really impressive, but look at the transition that person has made from where they were to where they are now. So yeah. Yes, sir. Yes.
He's had a comment for a while.
Oh.
So, do you still remember?
No, it's all good.
Okay.
I don't have my hand up for this.
No,
it's
no,
all good.
Okay.
I didn't see your hand, man.
It's
I'm
all good.
I'm sorry.
I put my hand up for
you. Okay. I did that to you last week too, didn't I? I'm so sorry. I promise I like you.
Well, that's why we have to be careful with the language of Ashdod. And the reason why I say that is because there's this language going around now. I just had to correct a sister in Christ in Oklahoma on the same language. Like, well, disinformation, misinformation. No, it's a lie. And so if we want to start renaming stuff, we better call things what God calls it. And so if we start talking like that, well, you know, that was just disinformation. No, you lie.
Yeah.
And so God doesn't speak like that.
Yeah.
We do.
That's right.
We have to speak like God speaks. So with the situation you just had, that person lied.
Yeah.
Hey.
Yes, sir.
I have a question about this principle, and it, I think, measures the character of you as a Christian, because I know how I feel. when I overpromise things and I can't accomplish what I said I was going to accomplish, or, and this happens sometimes too often in projects and jobs, work I'm doing, ranches, whatever. I get too far ahead of myself. I say I'm going to get this done today or something, and I can't.
Yeah.
My question is, does it bother you as a person when you realize that? And then how do you handle it? Because I have to reevaluate my, number one, my assessment of the judgment that I gave.
Yeah.
Number two, I've got to get back to the person and people and say, sorry, it just didn't work out. I mean, things break.
Yeah.
Equipment tears down and that'll stall you. But
yeah.
My question is, again, how do you as a person, when you do that, how do you feel? Because that's how I self-analyze that principle.
That's right. Yeah. And
I don't like overpromise. I try not to.
Yeah. If it bothers us, I think that's a good sign. You know, it's, I promised this person, I said I was going to get it done. Unforeseen circumstances has made that not a possibility anymore. If, as long as, I'm of the opinion, as long as I'm doing the best I can, and I had every intention of getting it done, and unforeseen circumstances are preventing me from that, then I would feel guilty. I would feel bad for overpromising, but, yeah.
Well, I look at the deeper principle. That's also the part of that. Jesus, God is not asking us to do more than we really can do.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
Again, you're talking about you and Olivia and being disappointed. I think that that's the real disappointment when you meet a person who's all talk and constantly letting you. At some point, you're probably going to walk in that relationship.
Yeah.
You have to.
Yeah.
The necessity of just survivability. But you're not going to survive too long if you keep promises from somewhere that can't
keep it. Yeah, true. Victor, did you have something? No? Okay. Olivia, Matthew 5,
33-37. Again, ye have heard that it hath been said by them of old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shalt perform unto the Lord thy oaths. But I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Neither shalt thou swear by thy head, because thou canst not make one hair white or black. But let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay. For whatsoever is more than these cometh of evil.
Yeah. And that goes back to what Ms. Tony was saying, you know. Ultimately, we have less control over things than we think we do sometimes. You know, and so when I make an oath, when I swear, you know, you hear people say, I swear to God that I'm going to do something. Well, you know, in that situation where that can't be performed, you've made an oath to God that you were going to do something that you're not necessarily always in control of. You know, when things break, you know, and it's not possible for you to complete your word, but you've made an oath to God that you were going to do it, that's not a good situation. So we need to be very careful when we make oaths like that. And again, the principle is let your yes be yes and your no be no. Yes, ma'am.
God valuing the vows that we make in both situations. And the first one I think of is, you know, with marriage. If we have sexual relations with someone before marriage, we're allowed to leave them for any reason and choose another partner before we get married. But once we're married, there's one reason that you can leave them, and that's it. And it's because I think with God, the promise wasn't made in the first circumstance. In the second circumstance, the promise was made. And then if you think about with God, when you become a Christian, it says that it's worse if you basically essentially marry him spiritually and then leave him, you know, Peter, because a promise was made. It's
yeah.
worse than you become a Christian and leave the faith than if you ever never became a Christian at all.
That's right.
So Peter. So it's just interesting because in both cases, it's worse if you do something, if you break a promise.
Yeah.
Than Peter.
That's a great point, you know, and again, something I think is so important to emphasize to someone who's about to become a Christian is this is a commitment. You know, this isn't, you know, a heat of the moment, you know, I'm really passionate about this, I'm really excited about this. This is something that's, you're making a promise to God and everyone in your hearing. This is something I'm gonna stick with for the rest of my life. I'm not going to do it perfectly. You know, I'm not going to be flawless from this point forward, but I'm going to do my best. You know, I'm going to do my best to be holy. I'm going to do my best to live righteously. So yeah, and we can't forget that that was a commitment. And so for us to, for me to become a Christian and to go to church, you know, attend worship every time the doors are open for 6 months and then to walk away and never look back, you know, what disconnect was there between when I became a Christian and, you know, I misunderstood something because that's unacceptable. It's unacceptable.
Sir.
Yes.
And also, that's where we come in because we don't want to let go of them either.
Yeah.
Because they are the babes in Christ.
Yeah.
We need to hang on to them.
Yeah. And exactly right. Our responsibility is, our responsibility in evangelism doesn't end when they go down into the water. It's like, you're a Christian now. Now go fly. Leave the nest. You know, it should continue. If you're studying with that person, that should continue. If you're spending time with that person to encourage them, that should continue. Not to just kind of say, well, there you go. Hope it goes well. Let us know if you need us. We need to be there to offer that continued support for that person. Yes, ma'am?
When a baby is born, you wouldn't do that to a baby.
That's right. Yeah.
That's exactly well, what it is.
The new baby.
Unfortunately. I mean, you know.
Just saying, any
sound. The social worker. Yeah.
Any sound-minded person.
That's right.
Which is what we're aiming to be. Mm-hmm. I'm appealing to sound-minded individuals.
Yeah.
You wouldn't do that to a baby when they're first born.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like God continually makes the illustration that we're babes whenever we're first baptized. So, and just people always expect, I don't know, baptism, like, I've arrived, or they'll just think that they have all this information now and they're ready to go. But it's a growth process. You've just adopted a brand new life and you are now introduced to it for the very first time. So you're going to need some help. And, you know, that's a reminder for the person who was just born and for the people that are there to help them.
That's right. Yeah. Kirsten, Colossians 3:9.
Do not lie to one another since you have put off the old man with his deeds.
What is the reasoning there behind being truthful? Don't lie to each other. Why? You've put off the old man. That is an old man characteristic to be untrustworthy and to be deceitful. That's part of the old person. And so when you bring that forward into your new life with Christ, it doesn't work because you're trying to hold on to two gods at the same time. And you can't serve two gods. Either you're eventually going to choose one. And that's the Pharisees. They're trying to hold on to two gods. They want to serve themselves, but they also want people to think that they're serving God. And it doesn't work that way. You cannot maintain that for any long period of time. Yes, sir.
To kind of capitalize on what Brian was talking about, especially the over-promising, under-delivering.
Yeah.
That mentality.
Yeah.
And I remember when I was a mechanic, and of course you wanted that next job.
Yeah.
And so I said, yeah, I can get this done in an hour. But you knew that was probably going to take an hour and a half. You know, but you wanted the next job.
Yeah.
And so motive. Mm-hmm. So how do you handle that? It's motive.
Yeah.
Why do I want that next job? Because, number one, I want the money from that job.
Yeah.
And so we have to check our motives.
Yeah.
And so if I can get my motives in check, then I can say, you know what? Let me spend an hour and a half on this job in hopes that I'll get another one. And so I'm not pressing myself.
Yeah.
Because then, now, I'm not only going to hurt myself, I might hurt the customer.
That's right.
Because if they're relying upon me to get that job done in a specific amount of time, they're probably planning their life around what I'm saying.
Yeah. And I do bad work because I'm in a hurry because I want the second job. Whereas, you know, what we've talked about recently is Christians are to be marked by excellence.
That's right.
You know, and I can't be excellent if I'm taking that mentality. It's like, well, I'm going to get as many cars today as I can, and whatever needs to be done to make sure I get my quota, then you know, come what may. So,
or you do a good job and it takes 2 hours, 3 hours.
Yeah. Yeah.
You don't get missed.
Yeah, that's right. Comments or questions on down to verse 22.
This on Matthew 5:33.
Mm-hmm.
That's Christ's Sermon on the Mount.
Yeah.
I understand that's the very first time that he spoke to man in this way. And so to put it in the light of what he's saying, he's running through spiritual things.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, spirituality, my understanding, put your mind and heart on what God would have you to adopt and have and own.
Yeah.
As you follow him. And again, he's talking about keeping your word. So this is in his first sermon on the Mount. He's bringing a man, and this is one of the things that he's saying, remember, keep your word.
Yeah.
So just the depth of maybe the significance of this first thing to come at man with to say.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's a good point.
Yes. And isn't it amazing that right after what he's talking about, the Beatitudes, it's the salt and the light?
Yeah.
I mean, he's telling us.
Yeah.
Don't stop.
Yeah.
Keep going. You're the salt of the earth.
Point.
Don't have it.
This actually reminds me of the parable of the two sons.
Okay.
The one who told his father that he was going to go and do it and he didn't.
Yeah.
And it takes me back to Ecclesiastes chapter 5, and it says, when you make a vow to God, do not delay to pay it. And you're considered a fool if you don't pay your vow to God. Not only are you a hypocrite, but you're also a fool if you don't pay that vow.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Verse 2, do not be rash with your mouth, and let not your heart utter anything hastily before God. For God is in heaven and you on earth, therefore let your words be few. Yeah, that summarizes it very, very nicely.
If you hunt down your words to be few, it means that you're weighing the words that you're speaking.
Yeah.
And I'm reminded of Jephthah's vow he made, and the cost that
yeah.
Was as a result of his vow. So just thinking about that.
That's right, yeah. Okay. Down to verse 23, Matthew 23, verse 23. Someone get 23 and 24, please.
Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithes of men and annas of cumin, and have omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. These ought ye to have done, and not to leave the other undone. Ye blind guides, which strain at a gnat and swallow a camel.
Yeah. This is a very good summary of the lesson that we had this morning, dealing with the fundamentals of truth. And Mike and I talked about this earlier. The scribes and the Pharisees were sacrificing the fundamentals in the name of the lofty things, the high things. So they were under the old covenant, it was important that they tithed. And so, of course, you're supposed to tithe from your crops. And so they were tithing down from the smallest of the herbs, giving a tenth to God of their dill and their cumin and their mint. Just, you know, things that were negligible, just things that were hardly important at all. But what were they forsaking? The fundamentals. That's okay. It's like a person being a master of differential equations, but not understanding addition. Does that make sense? Like you can understand these lofty things, but if you forsake the fundamentals, then you miss it. Because you know what a key part of differential equations is addition, and so. That they were missing it because they were pursuing the lofty. They were sacrificing the loving the mercy and the walking humbly and the doing right by God. They were sacrificing those things in the name of appearing righteous. And again, we just keep coming back to this principle. They wanted to appear righteous. They didn't want to be righteous. So they were willing to do whatever it took for people to think that they were righteous without actually having to make that effort to be that. And that's hypocrisy at its finest, because their priority was acceptance. They wanted respect. They wanted to be revered. They wanted to be admired by the people. And when that's your God, when that's what you want, then you'll do whatever it takes to get that.
Steve, I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
So when it talks about the justice and the mercy and faith, was that a reference to what, to themselves, or was that a reference to what they were administering to others? Do you understand what I'm asking?
I don't think so.
Is he saying that they did not practice justice themselves or mercy on themselves, or was it something that they were not extending to others? Mm-hmm. If another person did not give tithe of the tenth of the mint, Were they being merciful to that person? Or was it more of they were not showing the proper mercy in to themselves?
I think it may have been a combination of both, because they were very willing to deal out punishment, but their justice often wasn't justice. You know, they were willing to punish people unjustly, Jesus, you know, for whatever it took. They wanted Jesus out of the picture, and so they crucified him, accusing him of things that he hadn't done. And so obviously their justice for other people were lacking. So I would imagine that they had that for themselves as well. It doesn't seem like they were very willing to exchange mercy with other people, but they were themselves. So maybe it was a mixture of both, because like the justice they had for others, but the mercy they had for themselves. So I don't know. I'm not sure.
After that, it says, these you ought to have done without neglecting the others.
Yeah. That's right.
Well, the operative word, in my estimation, is the word omitted or neglected, which literally means to leave. They left that off.
Yeah.
And so I would go with your answer. You know, a person can be merciful in himself, but treat you like the scum of the earth.
Yeah.
You know, you make a mistake and, man, you act like you just robbed a bank.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
The only thing you did was just leave the cap off the milk. You know? Yeah, they put the milk on the cap on it, leave it alone. But,
I'm going to leave that alone. I don't know if there's a... Jessica.
That's not happening in my house.
It reminds me of that parable where the one man was forgiven, like, this huge debt.
Yeah.
And this other man owed him, like, a small amount. And he's like, go to jail. He got found out and was punished, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Someone get Luke 11:42. Matthew 23 is repeated in Luke 11, but there's a little bit of difference in the phraseology in Luke 11. Someone give verse 42. And this might actually shed some light on Miss Evelyn's question.
But woe to you, okay. Pharisees, for you tithe mint and rue and all manner of herbs, and pass by justice and the love of God. These you ought to have done without leaving the others undone.
Right, so they pass by the love of God. You know, and I think that would be referring back to the book of Deuteronomy, which was the whole of the law, is to love God, to seek His commandments, to love your neighbor as yourself. That's right.
A divine commentary on this is in Hebrews.
Okay.
4 in chapter 7, where it talks about the priest.
Okay.
Like Aaron, they were taken among men so they could have compassion among men.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They were themselves men or man, and they were then be sympathetic to the cause of man.
Yeah.
And you take this high court here, the Sanhedrin, these individuals that became very political.
Yeah.
The posturing was real.
Yeah.
Again, you consider passages like John 12, where many of the priests and these individuals believed with it, but they would not confess him because they were afraid of being cast out of their synagogue.
Yeah.
The idea, again, is impartial judgment. They just were hypocritical.
Yeah.
And they were able to overlook when it was convenient.
Yeah.
But these obvious things like Annas and Cumin and so forth, they couldn't overlook. I mean, they were finding those things hard. So I see a lot of that even today in principle. You know, we find it easy maybe to overlook our own frailty, but condemn severely and harshly those other people that are wicked sinners, unlike myself.
Yeah, 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 and I mean that goes back to the Pharisee and the publican praying in the temple, and the Pharisee saying, you know, I'm so glad I'm not like these other men, especially like this publican, you know, over here. And meanwhile, it was the publican that left the temple justified in front of God. So, yeah. Did you have something, Maya?
No, I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. All right. Let's read a few passages. This made me think of Micah 6:6-8. Miss Laura, Miss Little, would you like to read that for us? Micah 6:6-8. Royce, will you get Matthew 9:13? And Don, will you get Hosea 6:6? Hosea 6:6, yes, sir. Micah 6:6-8, when you get there. Sorry, I put you on the spot. Royce, Matthew 9:13.
Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice, for I did not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance.
What do you think that means? He desires mercy, not sacrifice. Is that so? A Jew hears that and they say, "Oh, okay, so I don't have to sacrifice anymore." Is that the takeaway? What's the takeaway then? Because God says that He wants mercy, not sacrifice.
It's a reference to the Old Testament, right?
Right.
They were basically saying, "Oh, we're giving you burnt sacrifices, so you should be happy regardless of what our heart is like."
Yeah.
And God's like, "No, that's not the case."
Yeah. Don, go ahead and read Hosea 6:6, please.
For I desire mercy and not sacrifice, and the knowledge of God more than burnt offerings.
Yeah. So really, it plays in very nicely with this text, because they should be tithing the dill and the mint and the cumin, but they should also be doing the fundamentals of the law. But they were sacrificing the fundamentals. So I think in essence, God is saying, I want both. You know, don't choose one. Don't look like you're doing something great and righteous in front of people. You also need to be doing these other things that you might consider to be lesser, but are actually, I don't want to say more important, but almost more important. You know, it's like it's much easier for me to go from loving mercy and walking humbly to tithing the dill and the cumin than it is for me to start from here and work back this way. This is more fundamental. This is much more difficult. This is much more important. And I would say that these are actions, and this is more of a state of my heart. So this is something I want to do to be right before God. This is something that's great, that's excellent, that I need to do. But again, it's much harder to go from here to there. To go from the dill and the cumin all the way back to the loving mercy and the walking humbly than it is vice versa. Because naturally, if I do love the mercy and I am walking humbly, then naturally I'm going to head in this direction. Naturally, I'm going to be led to those things of tithing the way that God wants me to. Ms. Little, do you have Micah 6?
Micah 6
through 8, yes, ma'am.
Chapter 6?
Chapter 6, yes, ma'am. Verses 6 through 8.
What shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before the high God? Shall I come before Him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, 10,000 rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of myself?
And verse 8, please.
He has shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? But to justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God.
So notice the transition in verses 6 and 7. With what shall I come before the Lord? You know, I'll bring burnt offerings with calves that are a year old. Okay. But then it gets slightly absurd. You know, will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams and 10,000 rivers of oil? And then it goes to the full length of absurdity and says, shall I give my firstborn for my transgression? Essentially, what the people are saying is God, you won't be satisfied. Regardless of what we do, you're not going to be pleased with whatever we give you. And so they were essentially blaming God. We're not giving sacrifices because you won't be satisfied. Even if I were to give my firstborn son, you wouldn't be satisfied. But notice what he says in verse 8. He's shown you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God? If you do these things, then you can transition into the sacrifices. But if you're just sacrificing without the heart there, that's appearances. You look like you're righteous, but inwardly you're full of dead men's bones. And we're not going to get into that. That'll be next week. But
that's the Pharisees.
Yeah, that's the Pharisees, Matthew 23. Ms. Evelyn, did you have something?
James chapter 2, when it's talking about partiality, but at the end of that context in verse 13.
Yeah.
Well, I have to read 12. So speak and so do those who will be judged by the law of liberty. For judgment is without mercy to the one who has shown no mercy. Mercy triumphs over judgment.
Hmm.
and he's desiring, I mean, we have to look at his mercy, I think, differently than what we do for each other, even though we should be looking at it the same way as him.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, we have to.
Mm-hmm.
Where God is looking to get you off. He's trying to present a way for you not to be punished the way that you're supposed to be.
That's right.
And yeah. That triumphs over judgment.
Mm-hmm.
But yet we're not looking for a person to get off. We want a person who's done us wrong or done wrong. We want them to receive the pinnacle of the punishment and so do them.
Yeah.
But yet we don't want that for ourselves.
That's right. Yeah.
So if we look at it, we want to have mercy, then we have to be merciful.
Yeah.
And we have
that's
to
be attitude.
Because the lack of mercy is going to be to the person who shows no mercy. God is going to show you no mercy if you don't show others mercy.
Why do you think that is?
Because that's just. Hmm. That's in his righteousness that he does that.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
We ought to be looking for opportunities to let people off.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this cancel culture that we live in is very dangerous.
Yeah.
And it's a mentality that if we adopt that as Christians, it's not going to be good for us.
Mm-hmm.
You don't cut people off because they don't agree with you.
Yeah.
And really, if that happens, that person needs to be called out on that immediately. Because that's a worldly mentality. As a matter of fact, even people in the world understand that if we keep this up, you're going to cause chaos.
Mm-hmm.
Because people make mistakes, and people ought to be given another opportunity to make that right.
Yeah.
And so, one thing that God loves, he loves mercy. He just said it. But he would rather you do what's right than offer a sacrifice. Now, that was told to Saul. To obey is better than sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if we have the mentality that, well, I'll just make a sacrifice, well, be careful. Only just do what's right. You don't have to worry about the sacrifice.
Yeah. Go ahead and read 1 Samuel 15:22, if you don't mind. 1 Samuel 15:22.
So Samuel said, has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice. And to heed than the fat of rams.
Yeah. Saul took a very easy to understand commandment and made inferences, threw away the commandment, and just reworked things completely. So he threw away what God wanted, took some initiative and said, I know what God really wants. He wants a sacrifice. And so I'm going to make all these wonderful sacrifices and he's going to be so pleased with me. But no, you threw away the fundamentals for something that God didn't ask for. And I know that that doesn't translate perfectly to the Pharisees because God did expect them to tithe. That was important. But for Saul, he did something that he didn't have to do. He did that and he sacrificed what God had asked of him. You know, I don't know if that was to stroke his own, you know, ego in front of God. You know, it's like, look at the things that I've done for you. I don't know. I don't know what his motivation was, but
I think we take the smallest now, the tithing, like you said, he wanted them to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But in the grand scheme of things, which would have been greater? The greater was for them to administer justice and to administer mercy and faith.
Yeah.
And then if they got to the tithing of the mint, okay, good job.
That's great. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's which one is weightier?
Mm-hmm.
But we put levels on things, and there are some that we should, because I think, was it Jesus that also said that the one that delivered me to you committed the greater sin?
Yeah.
So there is, in essence, an idea of a greater sin. We ought mm-hmm. not to commit any of it.
Right.
But if we're in the process of working on ourselves, then I think that there is a progression.
Yeah. Yeah, and that goes back to what Anna was saying a few minutes ago, is it's better for me to not know Christ, which is bad, than to know Him and then to leave Him, which is worse. If there's better and worse, then there has to be some sort of hierarchy, even if it's maybe not in the way that we think as far as like lying. You know, this was a white lie kind of thing. So yeah, that's a good point. Yes, sir.
Just as a point here that Jesus makes in Matthew 12 and Mark 2 relative to judgment, mercy, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And the Sabbath day, a little bit different context, but Jesus points out the issue of David, King David, going to 1 Samuel 21 and gathering five loaves of bread, showbread, which was really unlawful for him, that was set aside for the holy priest according to Leviticus 24 and so forth. And he's using that principle as an example here where they excuse David. You know, they could read all day long and see the problems of people like David, they would excuse that. And so when you get to Matthew 23, I think he's just highlighting here again what he's really already been pointing out from day one.
Yeah.
Okay, so my disciples are gathering and gleaning some corn on the way to the synagogue, or on the Sabbath day to the synagogue, because they're hungry, until the corners of the field which was legal or authorized. And you're condemning them for work. Is that really servile work?
Yeah.
Were they not allowed to eat?
That's right.
You know, and you overlook people like David.
Yeah.
And here is a man after God's own heart. It's just interesting to show, and again, in regard to weightier matters, you know, we need to be thinking again,
yeah,
like Mike said, very merciful.
Yeah. And it's, you know, going back to, there's a correlation between points that Mike made a few minutes ago. It's very, very easy for us to rationalize partiality in our judgment. You know, the people who are around me, my group, they're allowed to get away with things like that, you know? It's very easy to excuse people that I like, that I want to see the best in. But people that are outside of that group that I don't have as much patience for, you know, how dare they? Who do they think they are? A point that we've made in previous weeks is the things that irritate me most about other people are typically the things that I see in myself, that I haven't necessarily admitted yet. And yeah. Yes, sir.
Yeah, what? I was going to go back to 1 Samuel 15:22-23.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people today have good intentions. I think King Saul meant well.
Yeah.
But it called disobedience, rebellion, and as the sin of witchcraft, which was, yeah, I think, divination, like divination.
Mm-hmm.
So he meant well, but, you know, God expects, like you said, God expects us to obey. Obedience,
yeah,
is better than sacrifice. And he didn't obey.
And denominations today have the best of intentions. You know, it's like, God is going to be pleased with this. God wants me to enjoy worship. So isn't he going to be happy if I really enjoy worship? And so what would make me really enjoy worship? And then we're off to the races. Because we compromised. Because we sacrificed what God asked for in the name of something that God didn't ask for, where I'm taking initiative with things that I don't have the authority to take initiative with. God didn't ask for my opinion on the worship that he established. He didn't give me the authority to change things. That's not my job. That's not my role. So I don't get to mess with God's order to establish my own. And that's what Saul did. And that's what the Pharisees were doing. Is they were throwing away the law, throwing away the fundamentals of walking with mercy and justice and love. They're throwing those things away in the name of appearing righteous.
Sir.
Okay. Catherine.
These examples in terms of, you can't merit what you don't invest in.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, you're thinking of people who will not extend mercy.
Mm-hmm.
You can't merit mercy. Like, you don't, you haven't earned being able to enjoy that if you're not willing to extend that to other people.
Yeah.
Saul did not deserve to remain king because he was a bad king at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And he disobeyed God, and so his kingship was taken from him.
Yeah.
And then you think of the Pharisees, they had found themselves in a position of being spiritual leaders, but they neglected their job in many ways. And so that leadership that they so desperately wanted to keep, that was taken from them. And then I keep thinking of just this idea that you can't expect to receive or keep things that you do not keep with diligence. Or anything like that. And I don't know if that, I don't know if this is like going to ring with anybody else, but just the thought keeps popping back up with everything I'm talking about.
Yeah. Miss Little, did you have something? Laura? No? Oh, okay. I think you were scratching your head. Larry?
I think as we look at this, who's he talking to? Is Jesus talking to the multitudes and to his disciples? And he's talking about some very influential people. I mean, these scribes and these Pharisees, and he also mentions lawyers, by the way, that he's condemning all of these people. I mean, he hasn't read Dale Carnegie's book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. You know, if you're talking this way about a group of people, you're alienating that whole group. I mean, you're gonna get in the wasp nest here as he does this, because these people are influential and they can harm him.
And the power of Jesus' ministry was that he didn't care.
Nope.
You know? Yeah, exactly. Truth is truth. And he wasn't, it wasn't his intention to earn a reputation of being rough and rude. And sometimes people want that. They want that reputation of, you know, I'm going to say it like it is. You know, like that's some sort of badge of honor for being rude to people on purpose and calling it telling people the truth. You know, we all know people like that. And it doesn't come off well. You can tell the truth, but you don't have to come off as being very rude or harsh with the truth. That's Ephesians 4:15. The power of Jesus was he had watched the Pharisees, he had seen their lifestyle, and eventually it came to the point where he was very open with, this is what you're doing, and this isn't... I don't doubt for a second that Jesus wanted them to do better. He wanted them to improve. He wanted them to fix those things. And again, another point that we'll make is that there were Pharisees that were doing well, that they were following in Christ. Nicodemus was one of them. And I believe there were even others, you know, who were afraid to confess, granted, because they didn't want to be cast out, but they still had that faith there.
Yeah. He didn't speak to everybody the same way. To some, to the hypocrites and the people who devoured widows' houses, he let them have it.
Yeah.
But to the people who, like Nicodemus, came seeking and asking questions, or the common people who were just hungry like sheep without a shepherd, he didn't speak to them like that. And
yeah.
So it's the truth either way.
Yeah.
But he knew when it was appropriate based on who he was speaking to and their,
right.
their choices.
Yeah. We'll make one more point before we close. Do we express outrage about sin? Which we should. We should express outrage about sin, but do we express outrage about that sin, but then treat those same people poorly? That's what the Pharisees were doing. And it's interesting, this actually plays off Anna's comment. One of the most tender interactions that Jesus had with another person, in my mind, was the woman caught in the very act of adultery. Mm-hmm. He said, go and sin no more. He didn't tolerate the behavior, but at the same time, she didn't get a Matthew 23 treatment. So, for instance, homosexuality. Do we react with outrage, but then treat those people poorly? Do we treat them with disrespect? Are we rude and harsh with them? We should express outrage about sin. There's no doubt about it. Sin is not acceptable. And we see that reflected in Jesus' interaction with the woman caught in the act of adultery. But ultimately, am I pushing that person further away and hiding behind my outrage for their sin as an excuse for treating someone poorly? Because a person's sinful lifestyle doesn't give me the license to sin either. That's exactly what the Pharisees were doing. Do we harp on the evils of abortion, but then neglect the orphaned and the widows and those who are actually in need? Do we only care about the babies when they're in the womb, but then afterwards, well, then they're on their own? Which is better? We should express outrage about abortion. It's murder. It's murder. But then once that baby is born, do we just kind of cover up our eyes and then not do anything to help the people that are in that situation that did choose life? I saw a couple of hands. Sorry. Yes, ma'am.
He's got his hand.
Oh, okay. Yes, sir. Yes.
You got to get that hand in fire, buddy.
Thank you. I think like he does this, and so
questioning it kind of, yeah. I'm like, there we go. One of the biggest things I think is the way that we display ourselves, in the sense of if you are going to be against homosexuality and other sins, like if you start acting aggressively towards someone or like towards what they're doing, it's going to push them further away, like you said.
Correct.
But like we need to be open to them, like invite them to church, and anyone who's sinning, you need to be like, you can still come. Like, it's not going to be, we don't agree with the thing that if you do it continually, that's not the right thing. But we still love you, and we want you to come, and we want to talk with you.
Yeah.
And if we push them away, it's not going to go well.
Yeah. As a person, you know, we care about you as a person. Mm-hmm. And another problem I think sometimes we have is we confuse evangelism with arguing. With winning arguments with people. And my idea of evangelism is someone says that, you know, they have this really big band at their denomination, and then I show them 15 verses where that's not okay, that's not acceptable, and I did the Lord's will today. That's not how it works. If I push someone further away from God in an exchange, I don't get to call it evangelism. Because ultimately, I've done the opposite of evangelism in pushing that person further away from the Lord. Yeah, Brian.
Mm-hmm. You cannot separate the sin from the sinner. In the day of judgment, they'll be the ones that go to hell, not the sin.
That's right. Yeah.
We can have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness.
That's right.
It's Ephesians 5, before Ephesians 4:15.
Mm-hmm.
We can't forget Ephesians 5 as well.
Right. Yeah.
But some of the most fruitful Bible studies I've ever had were those who were in the darkest depths of the most abominable sins, if you want to call them that.
Yeah.
Your sins.
Yeah.
So we might be able to take this principle of the weightier matters and look at the weightier sins, mm-hmm. and that also can be discussed. But
yeah.
I don't like the idea, because I don't think it's biblical to say love the sinner, hate the sin. That's not biblical.
That's right.
Jesus said the sinner is guilty.
That's right. And
Proverbs 6 says, he that soweth discord is guilty.
That's right.
Hands that shed innocent blood are guilty.
Right.
That's the center.
Yeah.
So we can't undermine that, and we shouldn't take it. We shouldn't pretend with people that it's a light issue.
Right. And the point of this point wasn't to say, well, you know, to gloss over the homosexuality or the abortion. That's not the point. Those things are still sin. Outrage is justified in those situations. But at the same time, I don't want to go to the opposite extreme and push that person further away. Is the only point that we were trying to make.
So.
Yeah.
Get out.
Yeah.
This place is fixed to burn.
Correct.
So don't give yourself too much power.
Yeah.
Be sure you give God the power.
Yeah.
And I try to do that. I try to get out of God's way and tell a person that. But we shouldn't be ashamed to study the Bible with anybody.
Yeah.
But I think we sometimes, maybe psychologically, think we're tougher than we are. That's just my wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
I could be wrong on that. I admit that. But we ought to be very sober-minded to sin.
Yeah. It's true. Yes, sir.
John 4 is a great place. Don't have near the time to look at it, but when Christ approached the woman at the well,
mm-hmm.
the concept there is he drew near to her.
Yeah.
You know, we know she was tied up in some things, with adultery, you know, talks about the sin there, but the idea is he drew near to her. And then I think it's very important to look at what happens after he drew near to her. Mm-hmm. What did she do? He asked her to not go tell anybody, but she took off. Because she recognized the authority and the love and the compassion and all the things that people desire is to be connected with the Almighty. Anyways, the idea, though, the concept. He drew near when he had other methods he could have implemented.
Mm-hmm.
So you look at Christ's methodology when he approaches people.
Yeah.
There is definitely something to be taken away from John 4.
Yeah.
Should have mm-hmm. run by.
Evelyn, Anna, and then we have to close.
I just want to say that, you know, coming from a life of sin and being that sinner,
mm-hmm.
I will say, in all honesty, it was the shame that people put upon me. It was the ill treatment of being the person that was guilty of all of the things in which they said I was guilty of that caused me to look at my life more seriously and make change. And I understand this idea of being kind and nice, and I get that. but it wasn't the kind of nice people that that brought me to change.
Sure.
It wasn't the kind treatment, the people that accepted me as the person and not my sin, that caused me to change.
No.
And at the end of the day, I think at reality, we have to look at the heart of the individual.
Mm-hmm.
And understanding that the shame and the consequences of sin does bring a person to the point where they have to make a decision. And so I get the whole nicety, but in my personal life, the nicety wasn't what caused me to change.
Mm-hmm.
It was the people that actually said, you are guilty. And because of your guilt, I don't want to have anything to do with you. Because that's your lifestyle, I don't want to be around you. It was that, those people that did that to me, Christians that did that, that brought change to me.
You're a very tough lady because not everybody...
And that's what I'm going to say. Not everybody is like that, but I'm just saying that we have to weigh these situations, because what brings change to one person may not bring change to another. But that's why I asked the question of whether they were guilty of doing that to themselves or others, because I felt that at the same time, I was not bringing justice to myself. I was not giving mercy to myself. And I was not thinking about the faith, my own personal faith. Because all those sins I committed while I was a Christian. I was a member of the church, living in sin. So here's the difference. And so it is where sometimes people say I'm so harsh and rough because I'm that way with myself. Mm-hmm. I'm harsh on myself when it comes to justice. I'm harsh on myself when it comes to mercy. And so I am that way with everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So I just feel that sometimes we have to be honest with our own heart. And that's why the relationship with people is so important. Because when we get into a relationship with people, then we realize where they're coming from and what they need in order to draw them out. It's like, was it in Jude that Jude said, some have compassion, but others you pull them out of the fire, hating the very garments that are stained with sin.
Yeah.
So there's two different reactions to the same thing.
Yeah. Jesus.
Yeah. Anna?
I was just saying, one verse I think that applies to the situation about, you know, the sinner versus the sin and that kind of thing is Romans 5 verses, chapter 5 verse 8, where we see God loving the sinner, but treating the sin so severely that his son had to die.
Mm-hmm.
Like it said, but God demonstrates his own love toward us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. It's important to note that, you know, our love to the sinner can include tremendous tenderness and tremendous sacrifice, but it's not quite the same as acceptance.
It's not permissiveness. That's exactly right. And that's the balance. And just to bring us back to the point we were trying to make, outrage over sin is justified, but treating the people who are in that sin poorly out of the outrage is not justified. That's the only point we were trying to make. So bringing that back to center.